Friends, you're listening to Irish Radio Network, USA, the Flannelly Show, coming to you live from New York City. And I'm delighted, actually, to welcome a neighbor, actually, of mine from Ireland, from County Mayo, and her name is Margaret Connor. And she grew up on a small farm outside the town of Ballina in Mayo. And we might even, believe it or not, this is my first time even speaking with you, Margaret Connor, but you are indeed very welcome, neighbor, to
the
program. Okay. Margaret, where were you bred and buttered growing up?
On a small farm in Caltra Village. That village is also known as Ballyholen.
It's, for those who might know the town of Ballina, if you were to head towards Enniscrone on the Sligo Road, before you'd get that far, there is a river, a brook, and actually my guest Margaret was born and raised short just past the Downhill Hotel in Ballina, and in fact I was born, if you kept going up the hill, in a new nursing home in Ballina at the time. So we're both born and reared not too far from one another. But I just want to preface this by saying, you have written a book, a memoir, and
yes,
it's called My Ireland. And normally I don't read books cover to cover. I thumb through books rather than read them. And but I must say that I enjoyed reading your book, and because it's a reflection of how I grew up, again back in the 40s, and at age 17 and 59, I emigrated to America. I want to ask you, though, about your house, your farm, and its proximity to, to Ballina town.
Sure. So it was 1 mile from my house to the Bunry Bridge, where one turns off of the Sligo Road to go past the Downhill Hotel. And from Bunry Bridge, it was 1 mile up to the town itself. So essentially it was 2 miles, and we walked there continuously. That was our only mode of transportation until we got bikes. So I grew up on a small farm. There were all around 30 acres in the village. And I grew up in a thatched cottage, which was actually very beautiful, and I kind of wish they didn't tear it down. When it was kept up, it was picture card perfect, with lace curtains and geraniums on the windows, and a beautiful flower garden on front with roses of all kinds. So it was magnificent. But those days have passed, and I understand there are very few thatched cottages left in Ireland anymore.
Yes.
But they did maintain, they did need a lot of maintenance for sure, but they were beautiful when you kept up.
Margaret, you, if you fill us in on your early days, starting with, your dad, give us a feeling for, your relationship with your own father.
Sure. Well, as I talk in the book, my father spent his early years over in England working on the farms with his brother. And then he came home, of course, and he married into my mother's farm. And he was very motivated to introduce what he'd learned on the farms in England, obviously very advanced there. So he started to implement those on his own farm now, in that he was growing peas and vegetables and fruits of all kinds, and apple. He developed an incredible apple garden, and he extended his farm as best he could and leased land, and he introduced the growing and steeping of flax. So he was very innovative. He was also a great thatcher, so he was in high demand around for thatching the various houses. But he was a workaholic, and, you know, we weren't very advanced with medicine then. And so he caught a cold, which developed into pneumonia and pleurisy, and we didn't have penicillin, obviously, in around Ballinara at that time. It was after the war, so he didn't survive. But even though I was very young, I have very, very happy memories of him. We went to Mass together. We walked the 2 miles to the town and back again every Sunday morning to attend Mass. And I have very happy memories of him. Unfortunately and sadly, he passed away as a young man, leaving a young family behind him.
What age were you when he passed?
I was 4 years old then.
Four. Oh, my God.
Yes.
And you and his siblings, I know you had a sister, was a sister and 2 brothers.
That's right, Adrian.
Margaret, your mother, then now with 4 kids, and in the absence, of course, of your father, who, by all accounts, was very talented and a workaholic. What were the choices back in that time for your mother? Was
sure.
In terms of going forward?
Sure, absolutely. Well, since our dad married into my mother's place, she was essentially at home, so she never did leave that farm. She spent her entire life there. And her brothers were around, and what was unusual then is that the brothers didn't end up on the farm. She did, but she was caring for her own parents there. So the brothers were in town. She had 3 of them close in town, and she was very close to them. So she really had, and we had, a continuous family, if you will. They came to help on the farm at all times. So she wasn't totally isolated in that sense. So it was easy for her to continue with the help of her brothers.
You know, you, again, you were really a family, again, not devastated, but definitely I think it would have been, it must have been a rude awakening. You know, to now have the response for your mom and your family, to have the total responsibility for running the farm. That
yes.
Must have, was that, you were 4, but did you, apart from missing your father, did you realize that now this family was going to, you know, be very different from the comfort of what you had with your father around?
Sure. Well, being as young, I suppose, was helpful in a way in that I wasn't fully aware of what actually had happened. But what was wonderful about the village and life in general around there was the community. It was very strong. And farmers and families helped each other tremendously. And that was commonplace. For instance, if thatching, all of the villagers would chip in to help out with the thatching, also with the saving and the bringing home of the turf, and even the planting of the potatoes. Families came together and even sent their children to help with the planting of the potatoes. So it was a very extended community and very supportive. So I certainly as a child and growing up, I didn't feel that I was at a loss in that sense. And it wasn't uncommon for widows and widowers to continue running their farms. In those days, they didn't remarry. They pretty much continued. So when I think about the close villages, there were many such similar situations. Very often, the men were older when they married, and they would have a younger family. So, and of course, the medicine wasn't great. So there were a lot of early deaths, and that wouldn't happen today, given the advancements in medicine.
May I ask you about the village? And again, I want to not correct, but follow up on, I was actually quite excited to know that we were actually that we were born probably around a mile from one another in Ballina, but I grew up in Attymass, in the village actually of Carrick Castle, which as the crow flies probably a little more than 2 miles out the road. But the village and village life, which you describe so absolutely beautifully in your book, My Ireland. The village itself, how many houses were there? How many families were there when you were born?
There were 10 houses, and just one actually was a rented house. And also there was just one Protestant family in the village. But that family were extremely helpful in every way. They were better off than the rest of the families in that they had machinery and they were advanced. But they shared whatever they had so generously that it was a wonderful experience having them in the neighborhood. The rest of the families were pretty much the same. They had large, many children. And there were a few eccentrics in the village also, and I described them actually in detail.
Yes.
So
yes.
It was a mixture, but what was wonderful about it is that everybody fit in and everybody was important, regardless of the various personalities or dispositions that they had. It was really nice to see such a mixture within a small village life, and everybody played an important part in keeping that village going.
You know, in your book, which was very exciting for me, you had actually, in addition to giving details, a lot of details that most of us have forgotten, the National School, which for many would remember or at least know of, the National School was managed by the parish priest, and that was the custom throughout Ireland. So the National School, the primary school, that was his, education and memories of the National School, had a lot of variation from parish to parish. And you mentioned the school principal there, somebody actually that we knew. Well, my father and mother were school teachers in Attymass, the only two. And you mentioned Hugh Gallagher, who lived fairly close, again to Caltra. And how he, influenced kids. And what was the criteria, if not criteria, how did teachers wind up with teachers' pets, with some families, being favored? And how... can you just give us, a little bit on that?
Yeah. Well, Hugh Gallagher lived on a farm of his own, which he owned, and
yes.
He operated that farm. And so there were, of course, adjacent lands. And when conflicts would come about with the other cloth farmers, then he would tend to let that out on the children in the school, which was very unfair. He also was, he was a brilliant man, but he was very impatient. You know, for slow, what he would call slow learners, we didn't have special ed then, and so all children with all abilities were in the one school system, and some of them weren't as advanced as others. And he had, was really impatient with that. And so he would mistreat those children as if they were stupid or whatever. But, and so he really did favor those who had what he defined as greater intelligence. And that was clear in how he treated the kids in the school system. So he did favor, luckily he did favor our family. My oldest brother Jim was quite bright, very bright, and my one cousin Mary Connor was outstanding. So I guess he expected the rest of us to be equally bright, but that didn't always happen. So he favored us, I suppose, for that reason. He did tend to pick out those that he considered brighter children than others. But overall, he was a wonderful teacher, and an awful lot of students came from the town of Ballina to be taught by him, actually, and then they would go on from there into college and on to professional jobs. So he had a wonderful reputation as a good teacher.
Yeah, the school and your local national school there was Behi. And in fact, my sister, Betty, her mother-in-law was Nan Waters, and she had taught in that school for quite a while too, perhaps earlier.
Yes.
But how, if you could just tell us, how as a farmer's daughter were you perceived, for instance, in comparison to, you know, somebody of your own, you know, age group from the townie, and the townie being the nickname for those who actually came from the town, which in your case is only a couple of miles. Was there any distinction? Were you treated differently than you know, than kids of your own age from the town?
Actually, I think that the teachers, in particular Hugh Gallagher, preferred the kids in the country. He realized that the kids from the town were coming mainly to get a good education, and so that they could go off with that into higher education and degrees. So he did tend to favor the farmers' children, and we were in the majority, of course. So
yeah.
In that sense, I really fit right in and felt very comfortable as a farmer's child going to Behi.
Now, the town of Ballina, your own reflections on the town, since although you were much closer than, say, we were to the town, we were about 4 miles. And you a couple of miles. What are your fondest memories, or otherwise, of Ballina and what that meant to you and your family?
Well, of course, it was my first introduction to a town, and I perceived it as being very advanced. It really was and continues to be a very a good market town. It was beautifully situated, for one thing. You know, the Moy River ran right through it, historically it has incredible significance, which I outline in my story. So I had a very positive impression of the town growing up. But as I moved away from it and came back to it, I could clearly see that it could do with some upgrading. But now it tends to be at its best again, as I was there.
Absolutely.
I was there in last September, and they have done wonders with that town. They have a beautiful new bridge now dedicated to Mary Robinson, first female president of Ireland, and that wonderful museum by Jackie Clark. He collected such incredible documents from Dublin, That has drawn a lot of tourism to the town, and then from there they're developing a one-way road going from Jackie's museum down to the home of Mary Robinson. That house is being turned over to the town also. So and they've done wonders actually with certain streets in the town, like Knox Street now has beautiful pieces of sculpture along the street. And I saw such improvements when I was there last September. It really does look lovely. And, of course, hopefully they'll continue those.
What role did religion, you know, play in your household? And how much did that, was that part of the fabric, you know, of your growing up?
Oh, very much so. We were all Catholic, of course, and we complied with the teachings of our religion. My mother was a devout Catholic. She attended 7 o'clock Mass every Sunday morning. We said the rosary at night on our knees, especially after Father Peyton's campaign.
Mm-hmm.
We all, at growing up, we had lots of holy water in the house. It was sprayed over us at all times for all dangers. And we as children knelt down at our bed every night saying prayers. And as we went to bed, we were sprinkled with holy water. And around our house was endless religious pictures and fountains for holy water. So it was very much a part of my upbringing. And I'm very glad of that. I benefit tremendously from it myself. So I can only speak very highly of it.
The one of the advantages, I think, anyway, was after the primary school, after the national school, Ballina did offer, you know, a further education at the time known as the Tech. And was that, my memory is a bit foggy in this one, was the Tech mostly geared towards the boys, the men, and learning skills that would, you know, benefit them?
No, actually, the Tech was geared towards both male and female. The advantage of the Tech was that it was affordable for most families. Those days, you may remember, secondary school, one had to pay for it, and not all families could afford that. And the Tech was just a two-year program, and it taught children actual skills for work. The emphasis was on skills to go to make a living. So while the boys were taught mechanics and engineering and carpentry, the girls were taught bookkeeping and typing and domestic science, so that both sides could go out and make a living on it. The boys very often went on to apprenticeships, however, after the Tech, while the girls went to work, if you will, mainly as secretaries or whatever they could find in domestic science, cooking, being cooks in hotels, for instance. But those days, actually, there were no chefs in the hotels. There were all female cooks in the country anyway. So, and it was a changing time in Ireland because now both girls now were being trained for careers to make a living rather than being on the farms where they would marry local farmers and stay put. So they were able to get out into the world and make a real living. So that was an advancement for sure. But the Tech was wonderful in the sense that it prepared children to go out and earn.
Can you bring us to, say, adolescence and the social scene as you reflect? But I'll tell you, it's so well covered in your book that I think to get the shorter version of it, what do you remember about the social life as you became a teenager?
Well, I think it was absolutely wonderful. It was fun. It was such fun to go to those events. It really started for us on dancing on the bridge, which I describe, a local bridge in the next village. And we were still going to the tech at the time, but the priest unfortunately put an end to it because we were considered underage. But it began there with local people playing the accordion. And then once we started going to the dances, it was just fun, absolutely. We would spend all day long preparing for the dance to look beautiful with our hair and our dress. And of course, we didn't have access to cars then, and very often we had to travel distances to the dances. But so we hitchhiked, and that was not a problem. And we went in groups. And you know, the music was wonderful. We had the show bands, as I describe in my book.
Yes.
And they were outstanding. They were absolutely, they brought us all the latest music, you know, and they could take off any of those artists to perfection. Not alone were they great within Ireland, but they got a global recognition in that they played out in Lake Tahoe, for instance. So
yes,
we were so fortunate. We actually had them, you know, in our local villages and towns playing, you know, top music for us. We danced to.
Yeah.
So it was a very, very positive experience for me, I must say. I loved it. Those teenage years were outstanding.
Yes. And they also, maybe for the first time, it was easy to distinguish the show bands, all the musicians, mostly male, would wear uniforms, and they indeed were, you know, they played and sang very little Irish music as we know it, played very little Cayley traditional music, but it was incorporated for a bit of flavor, but they were just amazing. As I was reading your book, I was kind of I felt that you had much more experience there. By the time that I left, first of all, I was 17, so I wouldn't have had much exposure at that point, but they would go on to change or be a great addition to the music, to the culture of Ireland. And as you say, it would be hard to find a bad group. They were all excellent, and on that we can agree.
Oh, for sure. There were certain dance halls where a local band would play a more traditional Irish song, but not Cayley, for sure. And so if we went to those dance halls, we would be dancing around to some of those Irish songs. There was more emphasis on that in the country halls. But if we went to Inniscrone, for instance, they had a very sophisticated dance hall there. And you got the very best there. And also within the town of Ballina, they had a dance hall called, I can't remember the name, but now it was an Irish name. And there they would get the best. But those show bands competed, you know, and the dance halls had to be aggressive in getting them. They had to book them, you know, months in advance. And I recall how much I loved getting the Western People newspaper, every week to see what dances were coming up and who was playing, which bands were playing at the dances, and deciding which ones we would go to. There were dances throughout in the week even, you know. You know, as we know here in America, everybody works and they don't socialize much during the week. But there in Ireland, there were dances held midweek and on Sunday night, but never on Saturday night, because Saturday night you had to prepare to go to Mass the next morning.
Yeah.
But clearly on Sunday night, because it didn't matter. The next day was a work day. What did it matter? So it was such fun, really. We had many choices, I must say.
Oh, yes. And again, you know, I was referring to, you know, the show bands, and I wasn't taking anything away from the fact that there was plenty of places, smaller ballrooms, but if you went to Enniscrone, for instance, or indeed the place you were mentioning there, the name escapes me as well.
Aurismore. It was called Aurismore in Ballinax,
in Elkinsectomy,
yes.
Absolutely. Okay. But, yes, there was plenty of room, again, for traditional Irish music and the ballad singers who actually started to travel throughout Ireland at the time. Some come to mind, like Paddy Riley and many others. They had their own following.
Yes, they had.
And was great. Now, if you mentioned it in your book, I missed it. It was, or I don't recall, but the Fesh, that was the standard, was an annual event. The Fesh being a competition mostly for singing and to a lesser degree dancing. That would be held, you know, in Town Hall in Ballina, and if we're sounding parochial here, it's because we are. But that was that something that, say, in Behy's school, in the national school, was there much emphasis, say, on singing, or was that an also ran?
Yeah, one of the teachers of the school was always dedicated towards the singing. Actually, Mrs. Waters was there for a few years during my time, and that was followed by Mrs. Mulderick. The singing, we learned Irish songs, of course, but we also learned, of course, all of the hymns for Mass there. And in particular, we learned the Gregorian chant, which is incredible. And I still know that word for word today. So when I'm going to churches and I'm with the nieces and nephews, they look up at me and think, where did you learn that? Because I don't think they learned that today. But anyway, it was wonderful to learn that. But the teachers in the high school did not prepare us for the Fesh, if you will. The Fesh, as I recall, in Ballina, had a lot of Irish step dancing, competition for that. More than any other activities. And so those were people who, you know, were trained for Irish step dancing. It was traditional then, unlike river dance today. It was just strictly step dancing. But that was popular in Ballina in my time.
Yeah. You had mentioned there Nan Waters. I didn't actually know that you had been... around during that particular time that she taught there. The music, say music in the village, music in your house, was that paint a picture for us? Was there much, say, music, accordion, violin, the fiddle, flute, whatever, in your actual village, and how much was that used?
There wasn't a lot of that in my village, actually. Electricity came to my village in my day, and then for the first time people had a radio. We didn't have radios on batteries before electricity came about, that I recall, anyway. But once the radio got into homes, then we had live music coming from Radio Éireann and also from Radio Luxembourg. And I especially remember around lunchtime every day, dinner and hour time, they played all of this Irish music. It was wonderful, actually.
Yeah.
And it went on for some time. It seems to me that it went on for a few hours in the middle of the day. But the old-fashioned singing, shanty singing.
I'd love to
hear more of that today. Actually, at St. Patrick's Cathedral one time, there was a a lady singing that thing. She said she learned it from her grandmother in Mayo. But I'd love if we had more of that. It was really, really creative. And
yeah.
Hopefully it doesn't die down. But there was all of the jigs and reels, and so we had all of that. If we went to house parties, we did the jigs and reels around the house. But we weren't trained at it. We were just, you know, doing the best we could about it. And that would be, of course, to the music of an accordion. There was one family in our village, which I described significantly, actually.
Yes.
They held parties quite a lot, and they would have one man there playing the fiddle, so we danced to that. But he wasn't from the village. He was a cousin from a different village. So we did have it, indeed. But I think that the radio really reinforced the Irish music in the homes.
And, you know, in speaking there about, I think one of the programs that you are referring to there was... It was the Waltons program.
Exactly. It was the Walton program, and it went on for some time around when we'd be having our main meal, the dinner time at home.
Yeah.
I remember, you know, helping my mother. She would be getting eggs ready to take to the town to sell, helping her there, wrapping the eggs, and we'd be listening to this music. It was great, actually.
Yeah, and old man Walton began his programs with, say, saying, and maybe I'm paraphrasing, I hope not, if you do feel like singing, or if you feel like singing, sing an
right.
Irish song. And
indeed,
it was great,
yeah,
a great program.
Yeah, that
and,
was a great program, yes.
Yeah. And by the way, I think that around the same time, and perhaps even a couple of decades before that, on our side of the Atlantic here, particularly in areas like New York and Boston, Chicago, Philadelphia, and I'm sure I'm leaving out a lot more, that the Irish music, the Irish dancing, the traditional music, the great number of people who were actually so happy to, get into the, excuse the pun, the swing of the Irish music, they were not overshadowed whatsoever by the, the show bands and whatever. So
no.
It was moving onward here at a time when, you know, Ireland again was, to a degree anyway, influenced by whatever came through from England or Europe. And
from Europe and from America, yeah.
And from America. But I think that the interest in music with or without musical instruments, that there was something about the Irish young people in particular, it was no trouble for them at all,
mm-hmm.
just to
mm-hmm.
you know, to get together to sing. It's
yes.
Find a lot of kids coming
right.
or going
yes.
to school and
yeah.
just singing along.
It was wonderful, actually.
It was.
People just sang freely. And I recall any house event or we went to, one would be called on to sing. And
yes.
and one never hesitated. We always had our songs ready to get up and sing, no matter
yes.
where we were, to be called on. And I especially remember going to the dances and we'd be hitchhiking, we'd get into a car and we'd sing along, the whole group of us. As we went to the dance and returned. So singing was so much a part of our everyday life. As I mentioned in my book, both of my brothers on the farm, they went around their daily work singing or whistling.
Yeah.
And a neighbor, a supportive neighbor, pointed out, you can hear them listening for miles in the distance, and she couldn't pronounce their name. Was it Fischling? You could hear them Fischling for miles in the distance.
Fischling is right. Yeah,
right.
The day came when you and many others, particularly in farms and farmhouses, there was a need, and if not a need, a yen to, you know, move onward to, in those days we used to refer to it as go somewhere. And was that, I noticed in your book, and again the book, friends, is called My Ireland, my guest is Margaret Connor, the moving on was indeed for your mother at this stage of the game not that well received. Was that an emotional reaction rather than the reality that you either, you know, got a job in town or you went elsewhere?
Well, she was probably old-fashioned, and she probably still assumes that the boys would settle on the farm and the girls would be married locally. So it was hard for her. Looking at a dream.
So you went to Dublin and got a job in a hotel. How did that come about? Were you following an advertisement, or how did you mean?
I wanted to move on, I suppose, like all of my colleagues. Well, most of them were going to England to train for nursing. I still loved Ireland and didn't want to leave it. So I went to Dublin, and one could train in a hotel for management, if you will.
Yeah.
There is a school in Dublin called Carrigrove, where some people would go through the school system. But you could also take the training in a hotel, and that's what I did. And there was a two-year training program, and then I went to work after that in a hotel in a management position.
Now, in your training, most of that was actually a training in a hotel in just about every aspect of, you know, of what it took to run a hotel to be there. Let me ask you about compensation. This was training and job. There was a fine line there in terms of your compensation, your pay while training, not necessarily just in hotels, but serving your time was the expression that actually, it was an indication that you weren't going to get rich from this. You were just going to get maintenance until you qualified.
Yeah, absolutely. It was similar to the nursing training in England, where the girls trained in the hospital and were given little money. It was very similar to that in that hotel training. While we had room and board, of course, we were given almost like pocket change, you know, maybe I can't recall precisely, but it was enough pocket change that we could go into the city. We could buy clothes, actually. So it just kept us going, you know, little, but enough while we were going through the training, for sure. I promote such programs, actually, in today's world even. I just think there's such a need for practical skills and learning on the job. You know, and then you go to work with that training. I think it's wonderful. I think it's emphasized more in Europe probably than in America. I know that Germany is very big on that also. So I think it's wonderful.
What about, now here you are, even though your proximity to town and town life, arriving in Dublin and the cultural experiences that you seem to take full advantage in Dublin around your work to explore some of the wonders of Dublin compared to Ballina.
Sure. I was, as a teenager, I was very, very excited to be in a city. You know, it's a wonderful, uplifting experience when you find yourself in a city and you've got so much interest around you and things to take advantage of. And, down in the country, actually, we did go to the movies all the time in Ballina. So that was high on my agenda. Yeah, Picture House. That was very high on my agenda when I went to Dublin. So that probably was a first start. I didn't want to miss any of the great movies that came around, and there were significant ones, actually. I mentioned a number of them there. But then that kind of led into the theater, and now I had theater around me in Dublin. And, of course, I loved shops. I loved shopping and looking at fashion and, buying clothes and whatnot. So the city was very uplifting. And what was great is that I had immediate friendships, if you will, around in the hotel. And for training, I had a very close woman friend there. We went to the program together, and we had time to explore areas outside of Dublin. In the wintertime, we concentrated more on going into the city. So, but then once I worked in Dublin, I connected with some friends at home, and through them made others. Actually, I connected with Hugh Gallagher's daughter and son. They were both in Dublin then. And through them, I met others. And so that was great. Of course, then there were the dance halls in Dublin. But it was different. Dublin, I think I liked all of the culture very much in Dublin. But I found the dance halls were quite different from down at home. Like, they were mainly club-driven, rugby clubs and whatnot. So they were quite different, and they weren't as friendly, if you will. So I preferred to socialize, in a sense, down in the country, because I liked the culture of Dublin.
What happened, you still maintained closeness with home, with your sister, with your mom, your brothers. Was that, considering the time we're referring to here, the telephone was a luxury, and there wasn't much telephone service outside of the towns throughout Ireland anyway. So how did you communicate, and how often were you expected, say, by your mother to communicate, and how did that work?
Sure. So we didn't have a telephone at home, and so we wrote letters all the time, letters back and forth. I think at least monthly we exchanged letters and postcards. I would go to Easton's there on O'Connell Street and get a selection of writing papers and notebooks and cards. And there was emphasis put on writing and writing style and grammar, whatever. So that was a plus, actually. So that was our means of communication. There was, as you said, there were no telephones. That was the only way. And I stayed very close to my mother in that sense of writing letters back and forth.
Now, how long did you spend in Dublin altogether before you got to go abroad?
I was 4 years in total in Dublin, 2 years in training and 2 years working in the city. And then, of course, I had the itch to go further afield.
Yeah. During that time in Dublin, would you make many trips back back home? And how did you get there?
Yeah, so there was a train. It left Western Row on a daily basis. It was a noon train. It took all day from there to get down home. And so that was the first option. The buses then didn't go directly from the city down to the west. We could get the bus to take us outside of the city in that direction, as far as Lucan, I believe.
Yes.
And then, of course, hitchhiking was accepted over there and very popular. I was a young girl and I had lots of friends, and so we would venture off hitchhiking. And that was a fun way to travel, actually, rather than being on the train. So I do have very happy memories of the train. The train was very traditional. It had a big dining room with the formal china and tables, chairs, and
tabletops.
And but it chugged along, and it took, as I said, all day long to get there. Stopped at every known town, delivering packages and picking up people. But it was a lovely experience for sure. But the hitchhiking was something different, which we did frequently. And I described that hitchhiking and some of the people we met. We essentially looked for the Great Britain cars because they would always stop. And they were usually going much further, going west. So we'd look for those and get into the cars. And very often they were Irish people themselves home on holidays, you know. So it was lovely interacting with them and getting to know what their lives were like over in England. And very often we'd even stop for a snack along the way. So it was great.
You also had the custom at the time, say, if you took the train, say, to Ballina, getting back to Dublin was somewhat easier in the sense that there was a great network there of, say, lorry drivers or those who would be heading for Dublin. And if you got to know, if you got into that circle, the trip back would be by road and again, hitchhiking.
Well, you wouldn't hitchhike on the way back. You would know who was going back and when they were going and at what time, and you'd meet up with them in the town and go with them. And I went frequently with Ned McCann. He drove a big lorry. He was a dealer for Guinness Stout. He went every Monday morning, and you knew that, you know. That was assured. And so I would go with him. But it was a noisy journey. That lorry was so noisy. And it was high up, you know, so to get up there was a challenge. Those days, as you know, women didn't wear slacks or pants. We all wore skirts and nylon. So it was a challenge but fun. And it was a long journey up to Dublin then, you know, in the big lorry, talking to Ned and keeping the conversation going. And by the time you'd get there, you'd be exhausted talking and, keeping your voice loud over the noise of the lorry. But Ned was great for giving you a ride, and he, you know, it was nice to give him a fair tip at the end of the day so that he could enjoy going to the pub at night, you know.
Yeah.
So that was usually my mode of transportation. But I never did go out hitchhiking to return from Ballina. It was always pre-arranged, if you will.
Yes. Describe the day where you went home to your mother, and by then I would assume after 4 years she had was quite acceptable of you're moving to Dublin, and particularly in terms of you're being gainfully employed. And but then the day came and you had to tell Mom that you were going to immigrate. Was that a kind of an experience that you recall vividly?
Yeah, that wasn't a nice experience for her. And actually, even though I was in Dublin for the 4 years, she always thought I would come back to Ballina. And any time I would go down there, she would kind of be pleading with me to try and find a job at the Downhill Hotel, for instance, you know.
Sure.
So she always wanted me to be back home. That didn't happen. And of course, you know, you're young and you're ambitious and you want to see the world, and the flow of people leaving Ireland to go abroad was constant, you know, and they'd come back telling their wonderful stories about their experiences. And so, you wanted to do the same kind of while you were young and energetic. And my idea of going to leaving Ireland was that I would leave and for a year or two and then return, because I had good training. I could pick up another job at the hotel. The hotel people, the manager in particular, he really wanted me to stay and said there was always a job there, should I come back. So the objective was that I would go just to live abroad for a while, explore and have the experience, but then return to Ireland and back to the hotel. So that was the approach I took on leaving Ireland. It wasn't by any means a permanent immigration out of the country. That was not in my mind.
Well, when you got to the United States, this is where indeed the rapid success indeed kicked in, and a lot of it had to do with your ability and getting through the finest universities here, which led to, a career in Silicon Valley as a finance officer in the technology industry. Tell us about how one goes from the hotel in Dublin, or I should say from Ballinasloe and the farm to the hotel work in Dublin, and wind up in Harvard University.
Sure. Well, as you know, in America, there's tremendous emphasis put on college degrees. So I arrived from Ireland without a college degree, and even when I sought work in the hotel industry in management, I was told that that required a college degree. Here in the New York area, there's one school that focuses on that, but you have to have a college degree first in hotel management before you could get a managerial job in it. So all of a sudden I realized the importance of college, and of course one learns about Harvard, within a short time. So while I went initially out to my sister in California, I didn't stay very long there. I did come back to the Boston area with the intention of getting a college degree. And I started taking courses at Harvard. They have an extension program there. I started taking courses there. And then that ultimately led to a college degree. I think the great thing about coming from a solid background in Ireland is that you have great confidence. It's not that you're smarter than anybody else, but you're just very confident in your abilities to compete and just progress. So while I was going to college, I thought that I would finish that degree, and then I thought that I'd still go back to Ireland and maybe teach or something. But with a college degree in liberal arts in America, if you were to stay in America, not a whole lot you can do with it, in those days anyway. So I was advised to go on to go to business school, which I did, and I was fortunate to get into a good school and progress from there. You get into the American system, it's certainly all about careers and successes, and Silicon Valley was really taking off in the 80s, the earlier 80s. So at business school, half of my class were coming back to Wall Street, but I wanted to be in Silicon Valley with so much buzz going on about it, and that was the right choice for me, because I like working with a product more than a service. So it was the right choice, and it's very technical there, and the University of Chicago is a very technical program. So I think I picked both the right school and the right career. It's just where I saw my skills, actually. Well, I was going to the Harvard program. I took my first accounting course there ever, and so it was accounting 101, if you will, and I took the first.
Getting an MBA also from the University of Chicago, that had to be that puffed up your resume big time. But how then did you, from working in the Silicon Valley as, a finance officer there, how did you get into and become so outstanding in the field that your consulting profession, that in fact you grew from that to helping finance startup companies and whatever. That was a huge leap. And how did you find that?
Sure. It was kind of the trend there. Well, I went initially out to Silicon Valley, and I worked at large corporations like Oracle, for instance.
Yes.
So the internet era began then. It really started at that time. And everybody and anybody wanted to be in the startup companies. It was like the gold rush, the new gold rush.
Yeah.
Corporations had a hard time keeping employees because we all thought we would make our fortune in successful startups. So I went that route, and I'm very glad I did. Like, it was the first time I was really in operations, if you will, where I was really managing all finance and accounting. And one learns all aspects of a business when one goes into a startup, because you're trying to raise money, you're trying to manage the partners, you're working with all of the other executives on a very close basis and trying to grow a business. And you're working, of course, with the investors, and that was a challenge. So, for me, it was the right direction to go in again, because I tend to be a bit organized and focused,
Mm-hmm.
Not necessarily brighter than anybody else, just focused, and so it's worked for me.
So you come back to... not back to, because actually you hadn't spent time in New York at all, had you? Where did you come from when you left Ireland? Was it California first?
Yeah, I went out to my sister in California first. Then from there I spent time in the Boston, Cambridge area, getting a college degree, and then Chicago for business, and back out to Silicon Valley. I was kind of, Silicon Valley is very young. My God, it should begin to feel like a dinosaur after a period of time there. So you kind of want to move on from it. A lot of the people you started with are no longer. And I've always wanted to move on also and fit in wherever I was in life. And so I've always liked, well, from Dublin, I like the arts, and so New York is the ultimate in culture, of course, and I wanted to be close to some of that, because over the years, I would always visit New York, and with a line of theater I wanted to go to and concerts. So I had some friends back in New York, so that was fine. So I made that move, and I had thought that I would actually live in Manhattan, but it's kind of hard to find appropriate places there, I just live outside the town. I live in Greenwich, which is very
Greenwich,
close.
Greenwich, Connecticut,
I can take the public transportation in and out, which I do all the time. So kind of the best of both worlds. You have the culture, short distance away, and you live where you have trees and water around you, and more space. So
So
that's the decision there.
No, there's nothing shabby about Greenwich, Connecticut, that's for sure.
it's a lovely town to live in, actually, a lovely town, I must say.
Now, you also, you are a treasured member of the Irish Business Organization here, and in fact, you are, you're very involved, with a group of people who can benefit greatly from not only your experience, but also you could travel around the United States or somewhere talking about the success of reaching high above the bar, as a lot of Irish people have done, and we're keeping it to the Irish Americans, who have actually set out without, any limits to where they want to get to, and somehow do that. you know, pep talks, and you are, you know, somebody who has done extremely well here. I want to ask you, though, about your return to Ballina. Is there any part of you when you return to Ireland, you know, which you're well able to do and afford, but that says, I wonder what would have happened if I stayed, and if I stayed here in Ballina? Does that cross your mind?
Yeah, well, I'm glad that things worked out the way they did for me, actually, because, you know, as teenagers, you know, you could fall in love and you could marry the local person, you could just stay there and that would be your life. So I'm glad that it didn't work out that way for me. I'm glad kind of that I got out into the world and experienced the world. But when I go back to Ballina, I always stay with the friend I grew up with, Noreen. I describe her a lot in my book. And it's unbelievable. While we've gone different ways in life, we have so much in common. We could talk forever, you know, just forever.
Yeah.
So I never really, in many ways, left Ballina. While I went out into the world and experienced the world, I just go back to that town, and I just really love it. And the first thing Noreen and I do is we go to League Cemetery, and we see everybody and anybody we grew up with lying there, you know, and it's so comforting to be back where you came from. It's just a wonderful feeling, and I really appreciate it and value those trips back home to Noreen.
Your book, My Ireland, and friend again, my guest today, Margaret Connor, it not only is it extremely well written, but it's so descriptive. And for, you know, somebody like myself, who with the passage of time remember some aspects of our youth and growing up in Ireland, it's a great read. And, you know, taking us, our immigrants, and I know we've concentrated a lot on the west of Ireland and on the hometown of Ballina, but this is a reflection of growing up which could apply to just about any part of Ireland, and particularly for those who grew up on a farm or near a farm, you know. Or we heard, of course, and hear a lot about Americans going home to grandparents or aunts and uncles and being totally fascinated by, you know, farm life, the culture of Ireland. And this is a book I would highly recommend indeed, because it takes you from, you know, family through village, you know, through community and religion, childhood, education, the whole lot. You take it step by step. Congratulations on the book. And again, what's the best way to get this? It's called My Ireland.
Sure. It is available on Amazon and on Ingram Spark, and also on Barnes & Noble. So probably the easiest way for most people would be to look at it on Amazon. If you just Google My Ireland by Mario Connors, it'll come up. So that would be the easiest way. It is out in bookshops in Ireland, but not yet here in America. So that's what I would recommend if people want to access it.
It is so well, reviewed and indeed recommended by people up from all walks of life. For instance, Michael Dowling, an author himself, president and CEO of Northwell Health, who's from Limerick.
Yes.
And, you know, Mary Pat Kelly, the Irish-American
yes.
filmmaker and
yes.
Best-selling author. So many. And it is indeed a pleasure to have you as a guest. And again, Margaret Connell, thank you for spending the time with us. Good luck with the book called My Ireland, a memoir by Margaret Connor, on Amazon and fine bookstores on both sides of the Atlantic. Thanks for being with us, Margaret.
Thank you very much, Adrian. I really appreciate you having me on your program. Thank you.
Thank you, and friends, you're listening to Irish Radio Network, USA, irishradio.com, worldwide.